Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
In the market for a new car? Ready to replace that Toyota Camry and you're worried about news that Toyota has more complaints involving crashes than any other car maker? Detroit has a question for you. Have you dreamed of Ford? Ford sales went up 43% last month while Toyota's fell. In fact, sales for all automakers went up in January, except Toyota. At the moment, Honda, Nissan, GM, and other car makers may be getting a boost from Toyota's bad press. But then again, maybe there are simply more cars driving off all lots, except Toyota's. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee. From Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, March 3rd. And the takeaway for me is that, you know, actually, when you look at the history of car selling, it takes a long time for a good reputation among automakers to get completely destroyed.
Toyota's got some slack.
They've got a little of wiggle room, I would say, in my opinion.
Maybe not so much with our top story that we're following this morning. Just a moments ago, New York City Congressman Charles Rangel stepped away from microphones. He encountered the press today, announced officially that he is temporarily stepping down from the powerful Ways and Means Committee in the House. Rangel is accused of taking paid corporate trips and other conflicts of interest. It could mean a changing of the guard in the House of Representatives, the Ways and Means Committee, one of the most powerful committees in the House of Representatives. We'll have more details a little later on in the hour. President Obama will release his latest plan to overhaul health care today. If Republicans remain dug in, he's expected to urge Democrats to use a budget process called reconciliation to force a majority rules vote. Tim Kaine, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, tells NBC News this morning Republicans will have a fight on their hands if they use health care reform as a campaign issue.
If they want to run a campaign on bring back the day of kicking people off for pre-existing conditions, I relish it.
The president will outline his plan at 1:45 Eastern this afternoon. One additional detail on the Charlie Rangel story. He's announced a leave of absence from his position until an ethics investigation into him is finished. Celeste?
In Chile, the government says the death toll from Saturday's earthquake has reached nearly 800. Officials say that number is likely to increase in the coming days as search and rescue crews continue to discover more bodies.
Here at home, the
FAA, this is the story that you've been pointing out, is unbelievable all morning long. A child was allowed to direct air traffic at New York's JFK Airport. It's one of the busiest in the nation. Here's the sound of the kid directing airlines.
AMAX 403, contact departure, adios.
Contact departure, Idle Mexico 403, adios.
Investigators say the child was brought to the tower by his parent, who is a controller, on February 17th. The controller and the controller's supervisor have been fired. More now on the automakers. For the first time in nearly a dozen years, Ford posted better sales numbers than General Motors. They posted better numbers than just about anyone, actually. Nick Bunkley joins us. He's an auto industry reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Nick, is this a sign of Toyota's fall from grace or a sign of Ford's strengthening brand?
Well, it's a little bit of both, actually. This is one reason that these recalls are such big news is because Toyota had just become sort of an automatic choice for so many shoppers, and this is now causing at least some of them to just take a look at what else is out there. And for years the Detroit companies had been working to get their quality up there, and a lot of studies show that they have, but they just couldn't get a lot of people to even take a look, and this is finally creating that opportunity.
And we're going to talk more about this with Nick Bunkley of the New York Times in just a moment. But let's take a look at the markets. Asian and European markets are mixed. Futures are mixed. The Dow starts at 10,405 this hour. The S&P at 1,118, and the NASDAQ will open at 2,280.
Our partner, the BBC, has invited people all over the world to share a story about themselves and their hometown. You can find more details on our website, thetakeaway.org. But we're inviting you. What's the one thing you'd want everyone in the world to know about you? Take part in our invitation by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to our website, thetakeaway.org. We'll talk more about the project later this hour. And coming up, more about the American auto industry. Toyota's loss, is it Detroit's gain? Coming right up.
February was actually a very good month for automakers. Pretty much across the board, everybody was selling more cars, with one notable exception. In the midst of millions of recalled vehicles, congressional hearings, Toyota sales dropped 9%. Ford sales shot up 43% in the same month. That makes Ford the country's top-selling automaker. And are these just a blip on Toyota's radar screen? Could they signal a permanent change in loyalty toward Toyota among American car customers? That's the question we're asking Nick Bunkley. He's the auto industry reporter for our partner, the New York Times. And Nick, I have to wonder, the Toyota sales dropped 9%. To a certain extent, that's not bad news, because analysts had predicted it was going to drop by double digits.
Yeah, they actually did a little bit better than a lot of people were expecting, and even Toyota said it was better than they were expecting, because they were so focused for the month on fixing past customers' cars, and said they really weren't having their dealers focus on getting new people into the showrooms and selling them cars.
And to be fair, Toyota stopped selling those vehicles for a while, which had to affect sales as well.
Yes, some of those vehicles were unable to be sold until they were fixed, and Toyota says that virtually all of them have been fixed, so basically their whole inventory is available now, and they are entering March, they say, back in sales mode again.
Okay, so I have to ask you, we're asking about whether or not this is a permanent thing or just a kind of a blip on the radar screen, and there's a couple data points here. Number one, Ford Motor Company says they don't think that they're getting increased sales from Toyota's customers. They feel like Toyota's customers are kind of just not buying right now, and Ford is picking up new customers. That's one thing. And the other thing was this new poll conducted at the end of February by Gallup that says most Toyota owners still like their cars, and 82% feel they're still safe.
Ford, the increase that they saw yesterday is really not fully explained by just Toyota people going to Ford instead. I mean, the increase was a lot more than that. And Toyota seems to think that they aren't losing their past customers in very large numbers, but that maybe they are having a hard time right now attracting some new buyers into the brand. That people that haven't bought a Toyota before are thinking, why would I want to buy a Toyota right now? So they're either not buying something, or they're buying maybe a Ford or a GM product.
Well, if you want to talk about brands and brand loyalty, we need to bring in Bill McEwen. He's the senior strategic consultant at Gallup, and he's also author of the book Married to the Brand, Why Consumers Bond with Some Brands for Life. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning.
So I want to repeat these statistics from Gallup, from your company, that shows that more than 70% of Toyota owners say they still have confidence in Toyota vehicles, and something like over 80% still feel like they're safe. That's brand loyalty to me.
Well, it's certainly potential loyalty. I think it's important to bear in mind that loyalty is a behavior, but it's a behavior that's accompanied by a strong emotional bond. Anything that weakens that bond is obviously of concern. On one hand, if you have 80% of your current owners saying that they have confidence in you, that's terrific. But you don't want 20% of them to lack that high bond of confidence.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, let me ask you this question that I asked to Nick, which is about explaining this jump in sales on Ford's part. And we're focusing on Ford, but really Nissan, Honda, GM, Hyundai, even Chrysler all saw a jump in sales last month. But let's talk about Ford. Is Ford's brand strengthening, or do you think that they're picking up something from the tarnishing of Toyota's brand?
Well, I think the gap between Ford and indeed between Detroit and Japan with regard to reliability, confidence in the basic promise of an automobile has narrowed. I think that that Ford is now reaping some of the benefits of being in a consideration set that they weren't before.
There's been a lot, Bill, I have to ask you, because for years, Detroit automakers have argued that while their quality has steadily improved, they haven't been able to get that message across to the customers. Do you think the recall, Toyota's recalls, have helped them communicate the message about improving quality coming out of Detroit?
Again, I think what that has done is narrow the gap. I think at one point, the perception was that a lot of Detroit cars were poorly made. As you say, the reality was that they were much better made than they were perceived to be. To the extent that Japanese vehicles led by Toyota are undergoing the same kind of recalls that consumers associated with Detroit vehicles means that Detroit is not alone in having problems and having to rectify them.
Nick Bunkley, you know, your colleague Marcus Mabry on this program on Monday suggested that when the auto sales came out, the Toyota's losses might be Korean gains. But I was listening to Korean dealers around the country last night talking about how worried they are that if Toyota has a reputation problem, that it's going to affect them, that their fortunes actually lie with Toyota. They don't gain anything. Did you notice that?
Well, the Korean companies, Hyundai and Kia, they certainly have gotten some gains as well. They also had a really good year a year ago, which affects their numbers now. But there is certainly the concern out there that among a lot of foreign automakers that this could spread, and people think that you know, all foreign cars maybe are something to question the quality of. I don't know that that's you know, something we're going to see a whole lot of, especially as the, you know, the time passes here and the recalls aren't in the top of the news every day.
That's Nick Buckley with the New York Times. Bill McEwen, let me ask you, one analyst that I was listening to said that the other automakers are smart not to make too much out of the Toyota recalls because recalls happen all the time, and they don't want customers feeling like just because you have a recall, it means your quality is suffering. Would you agree that that's a kind of a good brand strategy, not to blow recalls out of proportion?
I would absolutely, because it's the throwing stones at glass houses problem.
Well, which is,
you'll have a glass house yourself at some point.
Right, and Nissan has actually announced today the recall of over 500,000 vehicles. We had a recall from GM and another from Ford within the past couple of weeks as well. So I assume everyone doesn't want to turn recalls into kind of a witch hunt. Bill McEwen is a senior strategic consultant at Gallup. He's author of the book Married to the Brand, Why Consumers Bond with Some Brands for Life. And Nick Bunkley is the auto industry reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks to both of you. And now at 15 minutes past the hour, let's check in on stories that we're following.
Some breaking news this morning. We've already mentioned it, but Representative Charles Rangel is stepping down temporarily as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. That's after he's been accused of taking paid corporate trips and among other allegations. He gave a news conference in the past few minutes saying he would step aside to allow an ethics investigation to be completed. We'll have Todd Zwillick live on this story in just a few minutes. We've been talking about the automaker's latest sales figures. This comes as we get news this morning that the Japanese company Nissan has become the latest automaker to issue a recall. Nissan is calling in more than 500,000 pickup trucks and four-wheel drive vehicles, mostly in the U.S., because of brake pedal defects. Nissan says there have been no reported accidents in connection with the faults.
Moving now to the aftermath of Saturday's earthquake in Chile, we've been reporting that at least 800 people have been killed in the disaster so far. But another part of the story is the economic impact on Chile. One port city has lost its $40 million anchovy and sardine industry. That's a big problem. Fish is one of Chile's major exports. The earthquake has also seriously damaged many of the nation's major highways, making it even more difficult to export goods. And in Texas last night, this was incumbent Governor Rick Perry.
I'm going to work to unite the Republican team to win in November by carrying the torch of limited government, unlimited opportunity, and good jobs for Texas.
Perry defeated Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison in a tough primary fight to become the Republican Party's nominee for governor. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. We're going to talk more about Charles Rangel stepping down from his chairmanship of the Ways and Means Committee in just a moment.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our first news take out this hour comes as a takedown after weeks of allegations and facing questions about his ethics. Charles Rangel, Democratic representative from New York City, faced the media this morning.
I have this morning sent a letter to Speaker Pelosi asking her to grant me a leave of absence until such time as the Ethics Committee completes its work.
which means that the chairman of the powerful House Ways and Means Committee is not Charles Rangel at this moment. We're joined now by Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Is this a changing of the guard for the Ways and Means Committee? Is Charlie Rangel finished, do you think, at this point?
John, it's really hard to say, but the allegation that has caused Charlie Rangel to step aside is not only the most serious, is not the most serious one against him, not by a long shot. The Ethics Committee admonished Charlie Rangel last week for knowing or having known that a trip that he took a couple of years ago to the Caribbean was paid for by a nonprofit that was in turn financed by corporations, big corporations, and that's against House rules. But there are a lot of other allegations against him that are still pending. Improper fundraising for a Charles Rangel Center at the City College of New York, abusing rent control rules in New York City, failing to pay taxes on a rental property in the Dominican Republic. So this is a temporary step aside, or so he says. But if the Ethics Committee rules against him in other allegations, it's hard to imagine how he could regain the gavel of Ways and Means.
Well, we both know how things operate in Washington. I mean, this move indicates that he has no support. There are no Democratic representatives who are going to stand with him. And so he's got to step down. These people aren't going to return after the ethics investigation, are they?
Well, I don't know about no support, but certainly not enough. And John, you're right. They won't return after the ethics investigation, most likely. But it was really yesterday where this started to become clear that Charlie Rangel's hold on Ways and Means was really teetering. Artur Davis, who's a member of Congress from Alabama, who's running for governor in that state, is an African-American member of the Congressional Black Caucus, and an ally of Charlie Rangel, said he didn't think Charlie Rangel should stay. Wow. After that, there was a bit of a flood, and it became clear it was going to be hard for Charlie Rangel to stay on.
Couple seconds on successor.
There are a number of people on the list. Pete Stark of California, Jim McDermott of Washington, John Lewis from Georgia, all senior members of Ways and Means. It's unclear who will take over at this
point. All right. Thanks for that. Todd Zwillick, our Washington correspondent, live.
Let's talk about sports now with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor. Yesterday was the last day of what's called the NFL Scouting Combine. It's formerly known as the National Invitational Camp. So, Ibrahim, what is the Scouting Combine?
It's essentially a job fair for the NFL. So if you want to get a job in the NFL, you want to be a running back, a wide receiver, a quarterback, a defensive end, if you want to play in the NFL, this is your chance and your opportunity to show that in terms of your speed, your quickness, your vertical jump, your broad jump, that the basics of your agility, what your stock will be in the NFL draft that's coming up.
So this is different than the draft, or?
This is different than the draft. This is a pre-draft sort of data crunch. So you get to see, so the people that are deciding who's going to fit in the draft and which position they're going to go, then NFL coaches can say, this is where I want this guy, this is where I want that guy, based on all these statistics that come out of this combine.
Right, and they put them through both physical tests and mental tests. So
correct.
Give me an example of the kind of test they have to do.
So, for example, you're going to do a vertical jump, to see how high you can jump, a broad jump, the bench press, and it's not like how much you can bench, it's how much you can bench the most amount of time. So,
Endurance,
exactly. Yeah. And that it shows your durability. And then also the 40-yard dash. That's probably the biggest one. For example, C.J. Spiller, who's the top running back prospect right now, he comes out of Clemson, he ran a 4.37 in the 40-yard dash. That's pretty fast.
And how much does he weigh?
He's 196 pounds, almost 200 pounds.
On the light side.
Yeah, so exactly.
But some of those 200
and just give you a sense also about the draft. Last year, there were two players that were sort of kind of not below the radar a little bit, and they bumped up their stock in the draft. For example, Mark Sanchez out of USC. He hadn't played a lot of games in college, so they didn't see a lot of them. But then in the draft, he said in the combine, exactly, he proved that he was – that he was NFL material. And also Sean Green, who became a running back for the Jets, who performed extremely well in the playoffs, in the combine, he improved his draft stock incredibly.
So who's doing well at the combine this year?
This year you have C.J. Spiller is the guy. He's the running back guy that everyone's talking about. Running backs and wide receivers are doing exceptionally well. Defensive ends are usually doing, and linebackers are usually do well because their positions translate well to the NFL. So, a quarterback may or may not have what the skills or what it takes based on the system that they came from in college, but the running backs and the defensive players, their skill set really translates well. So they're doing pretty well.
Do agents love this? I mean, do agents say, go do this? Or do agents want people to stay back and maybe conceal some of this stuff?
We were just talking about this. If you're a top prospect going into the combine,
right,
you probably want to go to the combine because there might be other people from conferences that may not have gotten as much TV exposure that are going to go and perform extremely well and might bump you out of your draft position.
So give me an example of a mental test. I read that they put them through these mental tests. What are they doing, grilling them on the rules?
Well, they're simple tests, and actually we were just talking about that. It seems a little sad that so many people don't do that well on the mental test, which proves that sometimes there's a social promotion that happens. They get pushed along in college and not really tested very hard. So the mental tests aren't very rigorous. They're just, I think it's just general aptitude and general understanding.
Okay.
Like, what's your favorite color? Stuff like that.
yellow.
The one interesting thing about the draft this year is that the NFL running backs have been sort of offloaded. Like the premier running backs like Brian Westbrook, LaDainian Tomlinson for the San Diego. And so they're looking to the draft to bring in this NFL youth movement.
Okay, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, the Takeaway sports contributor. He's talking about the NFL scouting combine. It ended yesterday. Now we're looking ahead to the draft. St. Louis Rams get the first pick. Detroit Lions, second pick. Coming up, what cities in America are still struggling economically? By the end of last year, almost all cities in the country were on the road to recovery, with one, again, notable exception, Las Vegas. We're going to find out why in a few minutes.
Coming up, if you're down on your luck in Las Vegas, you're not alone. It was the only major American city spiraling into depression at the end of last year. We're going to take a look at the so-called Economic Adversity Index in just a few moments. Right now, let's check in on some top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. The healthcare reform battle will come one step closer to conclusion today when the president outlines his final proposal, which will include, we believe, a few Republican proposals, although it's unlikely to win any support across the aisle. Senator Judd Gregg put it this way to The Takeaway.
Everybody should have problems with that bill because it's such an atrocity. It's like a giant asteroid headed at Earth.
The president is expected to urge Democrats to use a budget process called reconciliation to force a majority rules vote. A North Carolina school system has voted to stop assigning students to schools by socioeconomic background. The Wake County School Board, which includes Raleigh, adopted the plan 10 years ago, but it's grown unpopular with some parents. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke with Dave DeWitt, education reporter at North Carolina Public Radio.
Folks who disagreed with the policy cited that the high dropout rate, 54% graduation rate of low-income students, was proof that the policy wasn't working in the first place.
The change still needs final approval later this month.
In Chile, the death toll now stands at nearly 800, and it's likely to rise. Plane loads of aid have been arriving this morning. Earlier on The Takeaway, State Department spokesman P.J. Crowley told us the Chilean government had a specific wish list for the U.S.
The things that they're looking at, bridges have been affected, so they're looking for portable bridges. You know, absence of water and electricity, so generators, water purification equipment, a field hospital.
There are no plans right now to send U.S. troops to the region. Here at home, embattled New York City Congressman Charlie Rangel has stepped down from his chairmanship of the Powerful Ways and Means Committee this hour. Rangel, who's accused of taking paid corporate trips, says the move is temporary.
Until such time as the Ethics Committee completes its work.
The Ethics Panel is also looking into Rangel's fundraising practices and allegations that he failed to pay some federal taxes. And the FAA is investigating air traffic controllers who apparently let a child direct planes at New York's JFK Airport. The child, whose age is unclear, made at least 5 radio transmissions to commercial pilots waiting to take off. Taking a look at the markets, the Dow's up 20 points, the S&P is up 2 points, and the NASDAQ is up more than 4 points. Those are some of the news stories that we're watching this morning.
We refer to indices a lot when we talk about market activity. It's an attempt to combine numbers and show what's actually going on in a complicated system like the stock market. We do that in the broad economy as well. The Moody's consulting firm and rating firm has something called the Adversity Index. Moody'sEconomy.com and MSNBC.com have wrapped it up in a neat package that shows where in communities around the country the recession is continuing, getting better, getting worse. And out of 381 metro areas measured by the Moody'sEconomy.com Adversity Index, Las Vegas is the only metropolitan area still spiraling further into recession at the end of 2009. Ian Milchrist is the executive producer of State of Nevada on member station KNPR. Ian, first of all, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. I guess that includes the Depression, huh?
It's really stuck in depression right now. There's the usual kind of indexes: unemployment, home prices, the visitation of the tourist industry, all those kind of things continuing to slide in Las Vegas.
Now, as you attempt to turn those numbers into voices and news stories there at KNPR, you know, what do you encounter? Who do you talk to? And how do you get a sense that this adversity index is actually accurate?
Well, I mean, for the last 18 months or so, it's been construction and the tourism industry, which is really depressed. Hotel workers who used to be able to get 50 hours of work are now totally unemployed. And we're now into a kind of second cycle where government services are being depleted. We've just finished a special session where a bit of extra revenue was shaken out of the budget, and an $887 million budget hole had to be closed, and that probably means we're going to see cuts, furloughs, and cities across the state are struggling to try and reopen contracts and either lay off people or cut government worker wages, and we probably will see teacher layoffs as well.
We're going to hear her voice in a moment, but tell me a little bit about Julie Murray, someone you encountered in your reporting.
Well, she's the head of the largest food bank organization in Las Vegas, and she says that the recession has made the hunger problem much, much worse. It used to be just people who had underemployment problems and who had social problems. Now she says well-meaning middle-class people are also facing what the sociologists call food insecurity.
Well, let's listen to a food bank organizer, Julie Murray, turn an adversity number into something starkly human. Listen.
I was filling up gasoline near my home, and as I was getting gas, a father pulled into the gas station in a white four-door car with his two little girls and hung his head low and came over to me and said, I have no money for gas. I have no money for food. Can you help? And that gentleman, you could tell, was the typical example of the middle-class family who've never before accessed food.
It's Julie Murray, the head of Three Square, an organization that provides meals to the poor in Las Vegas. Boy, there is a stark example, Ian Milchrist, of economic headwinds right there in your community of Las Vegas. Hold on for a moment, because we have Gail Banzit with us. She's a reporter for member station KOSU in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Good morning, Gail.
Good morning, John.
Now, you have a more complicated problem because within Oklahoma, there are very different sort of senses of adversity in the communities that you're reporting on. Explain what you've come up with.
Well, that's right. You know, we're a lot different from Las Vegas in that we're not exactly a big touristy state. You come to Oklahoma to simply live and work in Oklahoma. So while our housing numbers remain strong and we didn't see that huge housing bust that a lot of other states saw, we are an energy state where our revenue is based off of oil and natural gas sales tax revenue. So we're not completely immune to the recession. But Oklahoma is known to follow trends late and kind of be slow to follow those trends. So we entered the recession about two quarters later than the rest of the nation.
Now, in terms of this adversity index, adversity has certainly affected the immigration rates in your state. How has that worked?
Well, the immigration rates, as far as I know, haven't really been an issue with everything going on as far as the recession, our housing markets, our economy as of right now. You know, a lot of those jobs in Tulsa and Oklahoma City were held by the same group of people before, so that's not really an issue at this point.
Although, aren't you seeing a sense of negative population growth in the sense that the people aren't coming to the state in the way that they used to?
Well, Oklahoma is just like any other state in that some small core businesses known in communities around the state for those certain industries and jobs, you know, have had to let people go in the past year or so. But our unemployment numbers are a lot lower compared to other states.
Let's listen to the confidence of Doug Emdy, who's the president of the Oklahoma Association of Realtors. And I want to ask you about this, Gail. Listen.
We think our economy is not going to crater or fall apart. And as long as people have their jobs and continue to have their jobs, I don't think you'll see a large increase in foreclosures in Oklahoma.
You mentioned, Gail Banzit, that energy is something of an insurance policy for the state of Oklahoma. Has it worked out that way in Oklahoma City or Tulsa or Lawton?
Some, but we based our projections a little high for the year, so we're kind of feeling those effects. But as things continue to go back up, we'll get back on track.
Generally, Gail, is the trend up or down in Oklahoma?
Right now, slowly becoming back up.
Ian Milchrist in Las Vegas, up or down?
Totally down.
Totally down. Headwinds blowing in Las Vegas and marginal improvements out there in Oklahoma. Gail Banzett is a reporter for member station KOSU in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Ian Milchrist is an executive producer of State of Nevada, a program on public radio station KNPR. Thanks so much for both of you. Coming up, our partner, the BBC, is hosting a competition to have people show off My World to the rest of the globe.
The whole of the township did not have electricity. That's why the name Duck City.
One man telling the world about his community. You can find more details on our website, but what was the one thing you'd want people to know about you? Go to 8778-MY-TAKE or our website, thetakeaway.org.
As of today, same-sex couples can legally apply for marriage licenses in our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Mayor Adrian Fenty signed the Religious Freedom and Civil Marriage Equality Act into law in December. He had very little opposition in the D.C. Council vote. It passed by a vote of 11-2. But beyond hot topic gender issues, my next guest says gay rights activists have a huge racial hurdle to get over in order to really see the benefits of this legislative victory. The city of Washington, D.C. has a population of about 600,000. That's largely made up of African Americans, and that's a voting bloc that in the past has voted against rights for same-sex marriage. Michael Crawford is the director of New Media for Freedom to Marry, and he's been fighting for gay marriage rights for years now. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for joining us. Black voters in California, they say, voted to ban same-sex marriage by a ratio of about 2-1. We got very comparable numbers when the vote came up in Florida. Do you dispute these numbers, or do you accept the fact that there's an opposition among the black community to same-sex marriage rights?
Well, I do dispute the numbers that came out of exit polling in Prop 8, which claimed that 70% of African Americans voted for Prop 8. What they found was that when they did a more comprehensive study of voters in California around Prop 8, was that once you factored out the number of times per week that a person attended religious services, African Americans didn't. There was very little difference between how African Americans voted and how other racial groups voted on Prop 8. And it's also helpful to point out that because of the size of the African-American population in California, the African-American vote could not have swung Prop 8 either way.
But so you're saying that this is a religious thing. Churchgoers vote against same-sex marriage rights, not blacks.
Yes, and it just also happens that some African Americans attend religious services more often than other ethnic groups. But what we've seen consistently across the country is that religious attendance is more a predictor of voting against equality for same-sex couples than is race or ethnicity.
But you know, whatever the reason for it, that still means that black populations are very often likely to vote against marriage rights for gays, and then that's a problem for you.
As we saw in D.C., there if we do strong outreach to African American communities, we can have support from African Americans for marriage for same-sex couples. I'm African American myself. Among the leadership of other folks who work for marriage equality in D.C. were a range of African American folks, both straight and gay. One of the things that has not been picked up as much as we'd like is the fact that there were a range of clergy leaders who came out in support of marriage for same-sex couples as well, including a lot of clergy leaders who are African-American and have churches that are in predominantly African-American neighborhoods in D.C.
But this must be a big day for you, Michael Crawford.
Yes, it's an amazing day. We're really excited to see couples are already lining up to apply for marriage licenses, and it's going to be a fantastic day when couples, black, white, Latino, Asian American, are going to be able to apply for marriage licenses in D.C., and next week they'll actually be able to marry.
As soon as Tuesday.
Yes, exactly.
Excellent. That's Michael Crawford. He's the director of New Media for Freedom to Marry. Been fighting for gay marriage rights for years. And as we said, as of today, couples can apply for marriage licenses in Washington, D.C., extending marriage rights to same-sex couples.
Good morning. I'm John Huckenberry here with Celeste Headlee. So what's the one thing you would want the rest of the world to know about you? It's an invitation the BBC has given to everyone in the world to tell a story about their hometown, the life that people live all over the world. We're going to talk about that contest in a moment, but we want you to tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE what's the one thing you'd want the world to know about you. We'll talk more about that in a few moments. Right now, here's a check on leading stories at 48 minutes after the hour. Breaking news, New York City Congressman Charles Rangel has announced within the hour he's temporarily stepping down from his post as chairman of the powerful Ways and Means Committee. Joining us now, once again, Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Nancy Pelosi pledged to run the most ethical House of Representatives in history. This is a strike against that mission, eh?
Maybe a strike against it, maybe a strike for it. I mean, if Charlie Rangel had all of these ethical complaints against him and he's stepping down, maybe that counts as a mark for her, but probably
that would
not
suggest, though, he was pressured. Do you think he was pressured here? Is that the story this morning?
I don't think there's any doubt that he was pressured. Charlie Rangel at about 8 p.m. last night went into the Speaker's office after some key House colleagues, Democrats, had called for him to step down. He was swarmed on the way out of there with reporters asking if he would step aside. He said there's no way that he would and that on Wednesday he would still be the chairman. I think overnight, consulting with his colleagues and some advisors, he changed his mind.
Hard to see how you resurrect the fortunes of Charlie Rangel at this point, eh, Todd?
He's got several other ethical complaints against him, John. A whole range of issues, from taxes to improperly taking advantage of rent stabilization in New York, improperly raising funds. These are all allegations, mind you, not proven.
Right.
But this is only the tip of the iceberg for Charlie Rangel.
All right, Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick, thanks so much.
Also in Washington today, President Obama will unveil his final health care proposal. It's expected to include several suggestions from Republicans, but the GOP says the concessions won't win their votes. Staying in Washington, same-sex couples are lining up outside courthouses in D.C. for their first chance to apply for marriage licenses. But because of a mandatory waiting period, couples won't be able to marry until next week. And in Texas last night, incumbent Governor Rick Perry defeated Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison in a tough primary fight to become the Republican Party's nominee for governor. Former Houston Mayor Bill White took the Democratic nomination. Finally, the FAA is investigating whether a child directed planes at Kennedy Airport's control tower. A child's voice can be heard on tape making transmissions to pilots preparing for takeoff one day last month. That's a look
at
some
crazy
of the stories you're watching this morning. Yeah.
Back in 1977, Planet Earth sent a message to the universe that included this music and some other music on the Voyager spacecraft. No one asked the Earth to do this, but it was a nice idea. And perhaps it was part of the motivation for our partner over at the BBC to launch a video competition called My World. Basically, a video message from Planet You to the whole world. What story would you tell in a 2-minute video to the whole world? Each video entry is 2 minutes. Take on a topic, a person, a sentiment. Entries have come in from all over the world to the BBC, capturing stories through the eyes of independent and sometimes amateur filmmakers. The contest was designed as an innovative way to show the world stories through the eyes of those who live it. And, of course, in the Internet age, with rich media and high bandwidth, we can all see these stories and share them as well. Joining us now, Simon Pitts, who is in charge of the My World project at the BBC, joining us from Bush House in London. Good morning, Simon.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
What a great idea.
Hey, thanks a lot. Yeah, well, it's very popular.
And you're sort of awash in all kinds of amateur video now, right?
Well, I mean, we're getting a real spread of stuff, you know, from Montevideo, from Uruguay, from Nepal, from Burma. I mean, there's a really incredible reach, and of course, from the U.S.
And, of course, it's these moments like this that I get so jealous of you guys over at the Beeb, because you just flick a switch and it comes in on all spigots from all over the world, including from Ron Guerin, who's an actor from Los Angeles. Ron, good morning.
Good morning. Good to be with you.
You submitted a 2-minute video, right?
I did, sir.
And we're going to play a clip from it in a moment, along with Matomi Senyolo, who's a 29-year-old from Johannesburg in Alexandra Township. Matomi, good morning.
Morning. Afternoon, because it's afternoon this side.
Thanks for correcting me. And you sent a 2-minute video about your hometown, right?
Yes, I did.
Well, let's play a clip, first of all, from Matome's. It's called Dark City. Listen carefully here.
Through the passage of life, this curse has earned itself many names. Some people call it Khamampian, while others call it Dark Seed.
The whole of the township did not have electricity. There were no lights on the streets, including in the houses. That's why the name Dark City.
Matome Senyolo, how do you sum up a community as complex and with as much history as Alexandra Township in a 2-minute video?
Oh, it's quite difficult, but I think I had to focus on the important element of the township, you know, like some of the famous aspects about it, you know, like
there are fiction names that people call it, and some of the historic moments that have taken place in Alex, basically.
Ron Guerin, what motivated you to send a film to the BBC?
I was tuning into a BBC World News broadcast and heard the advertisement for the competition and thought of my friend Charlie immediately as a subject for a short film.
And let's listen to him.
In my day, when I would be out here, I would be looking for something to rob. If I see something, a fat cash register, I'm going in there. I got to have it. They holding my money. They just don't know it. I've been in everything they got from juvenile hall, youth authority, state prison.
It's Ron Guerin's film about his friend Charlie out in Los Angeles, right? You found him on the streets of Los Angeles?
That's correct.
Now, what are you trying to say in that film?
I just wanted it to be a portrait of his life and how you can find inspiration in a lot of different places. And with Charlie, he found inspiration in cultivating his relationship with, or his spiritual relationship with a higher power, and he was able to change his life by doing that.
Well, you can see all these stories that we're focusing on and more by linking to thetakeaway.org. We're connected directly to the My World Project at the BBC. Simon Pitts, you know, again, it just, I get so envious. The BBC says, send us your videos, and people do. What is it about the BBC where you invite and people answer?
Actually, I'm not sure if it's about the BBC. I think what it is about is that people now have the means to share their stories that they didn't have before. I mean, even 6 months ago, I'm not sure we would be running this contest. You know, using the camera on the back of your phone just opens everything up.
And you know, it's beyond Twitter. It's full rich media. You're seeing characters in these videos. What have you learned about the world, Simon Pitts?
Well, I think one thing that's coming out is that a lot of people are caring a lot about the internet. You know, about the environment. We've had a lot of films coming into us from specifically Canada and the United States and also Japan, where people are really focusing on their kind of backyard. It's clearly a theme that people care passionately about, and they represent it beautifully. You know, some of those films are online, and I don't know, the sort of love that, and concern that people have for the planet is really one of the strongest themes that's coming out.
And no prizes. You know, in the United States, I think you'd have to give a prize. You'd have to, you know, give somebody like the Oscar for their best My World.
Well, actually, there is a prize. I mean, there are two levels of prize, really. One is that, you know, the work will get shown on the BBC. Some of the best stuff will get shown on the BBC. And the other thing is that there are curators who are arranging this material by continent, and they're going to choose the best films from each continent. Uh-huh. And one of the best films that they select will be chosen as the overall winner, and they'll get a great quality semi-pro DB HD camera.
Oh, well, there we go. That's fantastic. Well, Matomi Saniolo, what's your next project?
I'm actually working on the full length of that documentary. I want to make it like 48 minutes and maybe share it with the rest of the world, basically.
Ron Guerin?
That's exactly my intention. I have so much more footage that I have of Charlie. I'm working on putting together the long version of this particular piece.
You know, Simon Pitts, we should update the Voyager spacecraft. We've created a planet of filmmakers here on Earth.
It's really interesting. Somebody, you know, we were blogging this, and somebody said, I really love what you're doing. You're creating a mosaic of humanity. And I thought that was a beautiful phrase, because actually when you see all of these people's lives in a way that we could never see them before, you really do build this kind of incredible overall impression, and the detail is amazing.
Well, I'm still envious. Simon Pitts is in charge of the My World Project at the BBC. He joined us from London. Ron Guerin, an actor from Los Angeles, his film, inspired by his friend Charlie, is part of the My World Project. And Matomi Saniolo, his portrait of Alexandra Township outside Johannesburg, also part of the project. Thanks to all of you. Do you have a unique take on the world? You can take part in the My World competition. All you have to do is make a 2-minute quick video with any kind of camera. Tell us how you see the world. Winners will be shown both on television and online at the BBC's website. And tell us your worldview by going to our website, thetakeaway.org, and calling us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. While you're there, the only complaint about the dog show we held on this show recently was all the cat people who called in and said, hey, we want our cat photos in the contest as well. Calling all cat owners now. Send in your photos on our Facebook page, and we'll have our listeners vote on your favorite kitty. Find out how to do it at thetakeaway.org.
Well, the day for the photos of rabbits will be coming any day now, John.
My daughter Zoe will love that. We do have a rabbit at home.
Yes.
In interest of full disclosure.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.